We sat in silence for several long minutes, just being with the Archbishop in his grief and regret. He stared off, his eyes wet, remembering his father. He closed his eyes, perhaps saying a prayer. It felt like we were in prayer together, receiving and holding up his grief and loss. The Dalai Lama was the first one to speak, as he turned finally to Jinpa and spoke in Tibetan. "He's saying, Archbishop, that you spoke about how wonderful your father was when he was sober," Jinpa said, translating for the Dalai Lama. "It was only when he was drunk that these things happened. So it's the alcohol that is to blame, really."
"So I think even he is a very, very kind person, and when he was drunk, he is not the real person."
"Thank you."
Pillar 6. Gratitude. I am fortunate to be alive.
"Every day, think as you wake up, I am fortunate to be alive. I have a precious human life. I am not going to waste it."
The topic was gratitude, and it was fascinating to see how often the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama stopped to express their gratitude for each other, for all who were making their time together possible, and for each and everything that they were witnessing. I had noticed how the Archbishop greets almost every new experience with the word wonderful. And it is indeed that ability to see wonder, surprise, possibility in each experience and each encounter that is a core aspect of joy.
"You can be helped to look at the world and see a different perspective. Where some people see a half-empty cup, you can see it as half-full. Perhaps people would be moved to see that there are very, very, very many people in the world today who will not have had the kind of breakfast that you had. Many, many millions in the world today are hungry. It's not your fault, but you woke up from a warm bed. You were able to have a shower. You put on clean clothes, and you were in a home that is warm in the winter. Now just think of the many who are refugees, who wake up in the morning and there's not very much protection for them against the rain that is pelting down. Perhaps there is no warmth or food or even just water. It is to say in a way, yes, it is to say really, you do want to count your blessings."
Neither the Archbishop nor the Dalai Lama spent a great deal of time talking about enjoyment, perhaps because both of their traditions are skeptical of finding lasting happiness through sensual indulgence. But I had been happy to find that neither of them was opposed to the pleasures permitted in their spiritual lives, whether Tibetan rice pudding or rum raisin ice cream. Gratitude is the elevation of enjoyment, the ennobling of enjoyment. Gratitude is one of the key dimensions that Ekman lists in his definition of joy. Gratitude is the recognition of all that holds us in the web of life and all that has made it possible to have the life that we have and the moment that we are experiencing. Thanksgiving is a natural response to life and may be the only way to savor it. Both Christian and Buddhist traditions, perhaps all spiritual traditions, recognize the importance of gratefulness. It allows us to shift our perspective, as the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop counseled, toward all we have been given and all that we have. It moves us away from the narrow-minded focus on fault and lack and to the wider perspective of benefit and abundance. Brother David Stendhal Rost, a Catholic Benedictine monk and scholar who spent a great deal of time in Christian-Buddhist interfaith dialogue, has explained, "It is not happiness that makes us grateful. It is gratefulness that makes us happy. Every moment is a gift. There is no certainty that you will have another moment with all the opportunity that it contains. The gift within every gift is the opportunity it offers us. Most often it is the opportunity to enjoy it, but sometimes a difficult gift is given to us, and that can be an opportunity to rise to the challenge. The Dalai Lama's ability to be grateful for the opportunities that exist even in exile was a profound shift in perspective, allowing him not only to accept the reality of his circumstances, but also to see the opportunity in every experience. Acceptance means not fighting reality. Gratitude means embracing reality. It means moving from counting your burdens to counting your blessings, as the Archbishop had recommended, both as an antidote to envy and as a recipe for appreciating our own lives. The Archbishop had been awed by the Dalai Lama's ability to find gratitude even in 50 years of loss for himself and his people.
I have been able to meet many spiritual leaders like you. It is much more enriching, much more useful. Even suffering helps you to develop empathy and compassion for others. Exile really has brought me closer to reality. When you are in difficult situations, there is no room for pretense. In adversity or tragedy, you must confront reality as it is. When you are a refugee, when you have lost your land, you cannot pretend or hide behind your role. When you are confronted with the reality of suffering, all of life is laid bare. Even a king, when he is suffering, cannot pretend to be something special. He is just one human being, suffering like all other people.
In Buddhism, one can be grateful even for one's enemies, our most precious spiritual teachers, as they are often called, because they help us develop our spiritual practice and to cultivate equanimity, even in the face of adversity. The Dalai Lama's story about his friend who feared losing his compassion for his torturers in the Chinese gulag was a poignant example. The Archbishop had described earlier in the week how Nelson Mandela had been transformed while he was in prison. Mandela and his fellow political prisoners had used their time to develop their mind and their character so that they would someday be ready to rule the country. They had seen it as an informal university. These prison stories reminded me of a former inmate I've had the privilege of knowing. Anthony Ray Hinton spent 30 years on death row for a crime he did not commit. He was working in a locked factory at the time of the crime that he was being accused of. When he was arrested in the state of Alabama in the United States, he was told by the police officers that he would be going to jail because he was black. He spent 30 years in a 5-by-7-foot cell in solitary confinement, allowed out only 1 hour a day. During his time on death row, Hinton became a counselor and friend not only to the other inmates, 54 of whom were put to death, but to the death row guards, many of whom begged Hinton's attorney to get him out. When a unanimous Supreme Court ruling ordered his release, he was finally able to walk free. One does not know the value of freedom until one has it taken away, he told me. People run out of the rain. I run into the rain. How can anything that falls from heaven not be precious? Having missed the rain for so many years, I am so grateful for every drop, just to feel it on my face. When Hinton was interviewed on the American television show 60 Minutes, the interviewer asked whether he was angry at those who had put him in jail. He responded that he had forgiven all the people who had sent him to jail. The interviewer incredulously asked, "But they took 30 years of your life. How can you not be angry?" Hinton responded, "If I'm angry and unforgiving, they will have taken the rest of my life." Unforgiveness robs us of our ability to enjoy and appreciate our life because we are trapped in a past filled with anger and bitterness. Forgiveness allows us to move beyond the past and appreciate the present, including the drops of rain falling on our face. Whatever life gives you, Brother Stendhal Rost explains, you can respond with joy. Joy is the happiness that does not depend on what happens. It is the grateful response to the opportunity that life offers you at this moment. Hinton is a powerful example of the ability to respond with joy despite the most horrendous circumstances. As we were driving in a taxi in New York, he told me, "The world didn't give you your joy, and the world can't take it away. You can let people come into your life and destroy it, but I refuse to let anyone take my joy. I get up in the morning, and I don't need anyone to make me laugh. I'm going to laugh on my own, because I have been blessed to see another day. And when you are blessed to see another day, that should automatically give you joy. I don't walk around saying, 'Man, I ain't got a dollar in my pocket.' I don't care about having a dollar in my pocket. What I care about is that I have been blessed to see the sun rise. Do you know how many people had money but didn't get up this morning? So which is better, to have $1 billion and not wake up, or to be broke and wake up? I'll take being broke and waking up any day of the week." I told the CNN interviewer in June that I had $3.50 in my pocket, and for some reason, that day, I was just the happiest I have ever been. She said, "With $3.50? I said, "You know, my mom never raised us to get out there and make as much money as we can. My mom told us about true happiness. She told us that when you are happy, then when folks hang around you, they become happy. I just look at all the people who have so much, but they are not happy. Yes, I did 30 long years, day for day in a 5x7, and you have got some people that have never been to prison, never spent one day or 1 hour or 1 minute, but they are not happy. I ask myself, why is that? I can't tell you why they are not happy, but I can tell you that I'm happy because I choose to be happy." When you are grateful, Brother Stendhal Rost explained, you are not fearful. And when you are not fearful, you are not violent. When you are grateful, you act out of a sense of enough and not out of a sense of scarcity, and you are willing to share. If you are grateful, you are enjoying the differences between people and respectful to all people. A grateful world is a world of joyful people. Grateful people are joyful people. A grateful world is a happy world. Gratitude connects us all. When we are grateful for a meal, we can be grateful for the food that we are eating and for all those who have made the meal possible, the farmers, the grocers, and the cooks. When the Archbishop gives thanks, we are often taken on a journey of Ubuntu, acknowledging all of the connections that bind us together and on which we are all dependent. The Eucharist that the Archbishop gave to the Dalai Lama literally comes from the Greek word thanksgiving. And saying grace or giving thanks for what we have been given is an important practice in the Judeo-Christian tradition. Rejoicing is one of the 7 limbs that are part of the daily spiritual practice in the Indian and Tibetan Buddhist traditions. When we rejoice, we celebrate our good fortune and the good fortune of others. We celebrate our good deeds and the good deeds of others. By rejoicing, you are much less likely to take life for granted and can affirm and appreciate all that you have and have done. Jimpa told me there is a famous passage from Tsongkhapa, the 14th century Tibetan master, whose thoughts and writings were an important part of the Dalai Lama's formal education. It's taught that the best way to create good karma with the least amount of effort is to rejoice in your good deeds and those of others. Rejoicing predisposes us to repeat those good deeds in the future. Scientists have long known that our brains have evolved with a negative bias. It was no doubt advantageous for our survival to focus on what was wrong or dangerous. Gratitude cuts across this default mode of the mind. It allows us to see what is good and right and not just what is bad and wrong. Perhaps because of this bias, people are often skeptical of gratitude and wonder if it is a naive point of view or will lead to complacency or even injustice. If we are grateful for what is, will we be less likely to work for what still needs to be? If the Dalai Lama is able to find things in his exile that he is grateful for, will he be less willing to stand up to the Chinese occupation of Tibet? UC Davis Professor Robert Emmons has been studying gratitude for over a decade. In one study with his colleagues Michael McCullough and Joanne Song, they found that grateful people do not seem to ignore or deny the negative aspects of life. They simply choose to appreciate what is positive as well. People with a strong disposition toward gratitude have the capacity to be empathic and to take the perspective of others. They are rated as more generous and more helpful by people in their social networks. They are also more likely to have helped someone with a personal problem or to have offered emotional support to others. Emmons and McCullough have also found that people who focus on gratitude by keeping a list of what they were grateful for exercised more often, had fewer physical symptoms, felt better about their lives, and were more positive about the week ahead compared to those who recorded hassles or neutral life events. Similarly, those who focused on gratitude were more likely to have made progress toward their important personal goals. So it seems gratitude is motivating, not demotivating. Grateful people report more positive emotions, more vitality and optimism, and greater life satisfaction, as well as lower levels of stress and depression. Gratitude may stimulate the hypothalamus, which is involved in regulating stress in the brain, as well as the ventral tegmental region, which is part of the reward circuits that produce pleasure in the brain. Research has shown that the simple act of smiling for as little as 20 seconds can trigger positive emotions, jump-starting joy and happiness. Smiling stimulates the release of neuropeptides that work toward fighting off stress and unleashes a feel-good cocktail of the neurotransmitters serotonin, dopamine, and endorphins. Serotonin acts as a natural antidepressant, dopamine stimulates the reward centers of the brain, and endorphins are natural painkillers. Smiling also seems to reward the brains of those who see us smiling, making them feel better too. Smiling is contagious, stimulating unconscious smiling in others, which in turn spreads the positive effects. Did the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop smile because they were happy? Or were they happy because they smiled? It sounded a little like a Zen koan. Likely both were true. Whether we frown in displeasure or smile in appreciation, we have enormous power over our emotions and our experience of life. Impermanence, the Dalai Lama reminds us, is the nature of life. All things are slipping away, and there is a real danger of wasting our precious human life. Gratitude helps us catalog, celebrate, and rejoice in each day and each moment before they slip through the vanishing hourglass of experience. Perhaps it was no surprise to Sonia Lubomirsky that gratitude is a factor that seems to influence happiness along with our ability to reframe negative events into positive ones. The final factor she found was our ability to be kind and generous toward others, which the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop saw as two separate but related pillars, compassion and generosity. When we recognize all that we have been given, it is our natural response to want to care for and give to others. Pillar 7, compassion, something we want to become.
Too much self-centered thinking is the source of suffering. A compassionate concern for others' well-being is the source of happiness. On this planet, over the last 3,000 years, different religious traditions have developed. All these traditions carry the same message, the message of love. So, the purpose of these different traditions is to promote and strengthen the value of love, compassion. So different medicine, but same aim, to cure our pain, our illness. As we mentioned, even scientists now say, basic human nature is compassionate.
Both the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop had emphasized that this compassionate concern for others is instinctual, and that we are hardwired to connect and to care. However, as the Archbishop explained earlier in the week, it takes time. We are growing and learning how to be compassionate, how to be caring, how to be human. The Buddha supposedly said, "What is that one thing which when you possess, you have all other virtues? It is compassion." It is worth taking a moment to think about what compassion really means, since it is a term that is often misunderstood. Jinpa, with the help of colleagues, created the Compassion Cultivation Training at the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education at Stanford University School of Medicine. In his marvelous book, A Fearless Heart, How the Courage to be Compassionate Can Transform Our Lives, he explains, "Compassion is a sense of concern that arises when we are confronted with another's suffering and feel motivated to see that suffering relieved." He adds, "Compassion is what connects the feeling of empathy to acts of kindness, generosity, and other expressions of altruistic tendencies." The biblical Hebrew word for compassion, rachamim, comes from the root word for womb, rechem. And the Dalai Lama often says that it is from our mother's nurturing that we learn compassion. He also says that his mother was his first teacher of compassion. It is from being nurtured and in turn nurturing our own children that we discover the nature of compassion. Compassion is in many ways expanding this maternal instinct that was so pivotal to the survival of our species. The Dalai Lama tells a story of flying one night from Japan to San Francisco. Sitting close to him was a couple with two children, a very active boy of around 3 years old and a baby. At the beginning, it seemed the father was helping to look after the children, often walking about with the young boy, who kept running through the aisles. In the middle of the night, the Dalai Lama looked over and saw that the father was fast asleep, and the mother was left trying to take care of the two tired and cranky children by herself. The Dalai Lama handed the boy a piece of candy as he noticed the mother's swollen eyes and exhaustion. "Seriously," he said later, "I thought about it, and I don't think I would have had that kind of patience." The Dalai Lama's comment echoed a topic I have discussed with quite a few religious seekers and parents. It probably takes many years of monastic practice to equal the spiritual growth generated by one sleepless night with a sick child. While we all carry what the Dalai Lama calls the seed of compassion, from our own experience of being nurtured by others, compassion is actually a skill that can be cultivated. It is something we can learn to develop and then use to extend our circle of concern beyond our immediate family to others. It helps when one recognizes our shared humanity. Archbishop, Your Holiness, over the course of the week, you have talked so much about compassion that I thought we might need to rename your collaboration, The Book of Compassion. In this session, I hope we can explore compassion even more deeply. While everyone agrees that being compassionate is a worthy goal, it is hard for many people to understand or to put into practice. The word compassion, as we have said, literally means suffering with. So what would you say to the person who says, "I have enough problems of my own. Why should I worry about being more compassionate and think about others who are suffering?"
As we have discussed, we are social animals. Even for kings or queens or spiritual leaders, their survival depends on the rest of the community. So therefore, if you want a happy life and fewer problems, you have to develop a serious concern for the well-being of others. So then, when someone is passing through a difficult period or difficult circumstances, then automatically will come a sense of concern for their well-being. And if there is the possibility to help, then you can help. If there is no possibility to help, you can just pray or wish them well. Even other social animals have this same concern for each other. I think the other day I also mentioned how scientists have found that when two mice are together, if one is injured, the other will lick it. The injured mouse that is being licked by another mouse will heal much faster than a mouse that is alone. This concern for others is something very precious. We humans have a special brain, but this brain causes a lot of suffering because it is always thinking, me, 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 me. The more time you spend thinking about yourself, the more suffering you will experience. The incredible thing is that when we think of alleviating other people's suffering, our own suffering is reduced. This is the true secret to happiness. So this is a very practical thing. In fact, it is common sense.
So will the mouse that does the licking benefit as well, I asked? The Dalai Lama spoke in Tibetan, and Jinpa translated. One could argue that the mouse doing the licking is better off and is also in a calmer state of mind. The Archbishop laughed at all of this discussion of mice and the need for scientific justifications for what to him was so obviously at the very core of our humanity.
I would say that one of the ways to show that compassion is something we want to become is the very fact that we admire compassionate people. You know, you don't, very, very few of us, admire a vengeful person. Why do they come to listen to the Dalai Lama? It is very largely because of who he has become. They are attracted to him because of his spiritual stature, a stature that has been created by the fact of his caring for others, even in the midst of his own suffering, the suffering of being in exile.
Still, Archbishop, the question for many people is that they have so many of their own problems. They may admire both of you and say, well, that's wonderful, they're incredibly holy men, but I've got to feed my children, and I have to do my job, and I don't have enough money. Or they say, if I am compassionate, others will take advantage of me, because it's a dog-eat-dog world. So why is compassion in their self-interest? How does it help the rest of their goals in life?
Yes, I would hope they would try it out, because it's very difficult just speaking about it theoretically. It's something that you have to work out in actual life. Try out being kind when you are walking in the street and say good morning to the people you are passing, or smile when you are not feeling like it. I bet you my bottom dollar, in a very short period of time, this pall of self-regard, which is a bad self-regard, lifts. It's universal. When you try it out, why does it work? We really are wired to be caring of the other. And when we go against that fundamental law of our being, whether we like it or not, it is going to have deleterious consequences for us. When you say I, as His Holiness pointed out, you are going to come a cropper. But when you say, how can I help, even in the midst of your deep anguish, it's got an alchemy that transforms your pain. It may not take it away, but it becomes in a way bearable, more than it was at the time when you were just saying, poor me, thinking only about yourself. When your doorbell rings, and you're going to open it as a Christian, I would make the sign of a cross over whoever it is who is there, which is just to say, let them be blessed. They may not be in desperate need of anything, but they might also be. And you are, in that process, being helped not to be so self-regarding, so constantly conscious of your anguish. As you remember, yes, compassion is absolutely essential. It's like oxygen.
Very right, very right. Thinking me, me, me automatically brings fear, a sense of insecurity and distrust. That kind of person will never be a happy person. At the end of that person's life, their neighbor will be happy that that person is gone, yes?
You are quite right, yes.
If you look after others, particularly those who are in need, then when you are passing through some difficulties, there are plenty of people you can ask for help. Then, at the end, many people will feel that they have really lost a wonderful person. So it's just common sense. And then I want to say, look at Stalin's picture, or Hitler's picture. and compare it to the face of Mahatma Gandhi, and also the face of this person.
He was pointing to the Archbishop.
You can see that the person who has all the power, but who lacks compassion, who only thinks about control, can never be happy. I think during the night they do not have sound sleep. They always have fear. Many dictators sleep in a different place every night. So what creates that kind of fear is their own way of thinking, their own mind. Mahatma Gandhi's face was always smiling. And to some extent, I think, Nelson Mandela also. Because he followed the path of nonviolence, and because he was not obsessed with power, millions of people remember him. And if he had become a dictator, then nobody would have mourned his death. So that's my view. Quite simple.
I was pushing the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop hard because I did not want to leave compassion in the lofty realm of saints and lamas. I knew they were suggesting that it was a pillar of joy for the rest of us, and I wanted to understand why it had been so hard for our modern culture to embrace. So that same cynic might say, if compassion is so natural, and it's in many ways the ethical root of all religions, and for thousands of years people have been preaching and teaching compassion, then why is there such a lack of compassion in the world?
Our human nature has been distorted. I mean, we are actually quite remarkable creatures. In our religions, I am created in the image of God. I am a God-carrier. It's fantastic. I have to be growing in God-likeness, in caring for the other. I know that each time I have acted compassionately, I have experienced a joy in me that I find in nothing else. And even the cynic will have to admit that it is how we are wired. We're wired to be other-regarding. We shrivel if there's no other. It's really a glorious thing. When you say, I will care for only me, in an extraordinary way, that me shrivels and gets smaller and smaller. And you find satisfaction and joy increasingly elusive. Then you want to grab and try this and try that, but in the end, you don't find satisfaction.
The modern world is suspicious of compassion because we have accepted the belief that nature is red in tooth and claw, that we are fundamentally competing against everyone and everything. According to this perspective in our lives of getting and spending, compassion is at best a luxury, or at worst a self-defeating folly of the weak. Yet evolutionary science has come to see cooperation, and its core emotions of empathy, compassion, and generosity, as fundamental to our species' survival. What the Dalai Lama was describing, explaining that compassion is in our self-interest, evolutionary biologists have called reciprocal altruism. I scratch your back today, and you scratch my back tomorrow. This arrangement was so fundamental to our survival that children as young as 6 months have been shown to have a clear preference for toys that reflect helping rather than hindering. When we help others, we often experience what has been called the helper's high, as endorphins are released in our brain, leading to a euphoric state. The same reward centers of the brain seem to light up when we are doing something compassionate as when we think of chocolate. The warm feeling we get from helping others comes from the release of oxytocin, the same hormone that is released by lactating mothers. This hormone seems to have health benefits, including the reduction of inflammation in the cardiovascular system. Compassion literally makes our heart healthy and happy. Compassion also seems to be contagious. When we see others being compassionate, we are more likely to be compassionate. This results in a feeling called moral elevation, and that is one of the aspects of joy that Paul Ekman had identified. Recent research by social scientists Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler suggests that this ripple effect can extend out to 2 and 3 degrees of separation. In other words, experiments with large numbers of people show that if you are kind and compassionate, your friends' friends, and even your friends' friends' friends are more likely to become kind and compassionate. We fear compassion because we're afraid of experiencing the suffering, the vulnerability, and the helplessness that can come from having an open heart. Psychologist Paul Gilbert found that many people are afraid that if they are compassionate, they will be taken advantage of, that others will become dependent on them, and that they won't be able to handle others' distress. One of the differences between empathy and compassion is that while empathy is simply experiencing another's emotion, compassion is a more empowered state where we want what is best for the other person. As the Dalai Lama has described it, if we see a person who is being crushed by a rock, the goal is not to get under the rock and feel what they are feeling. It is to help to remove the rock. Many people are also afraid of receiving compassion from others because they are afraid that others will want something in return, or that they will at least feel indebted. Finally, many people are even afraid of being self-compassionate because they are afraid they will become weak, that they will not work as hard, or that they will be overcome with sadness and grief. Gilbert says, "Compassion can flow naturally when we understand and work to remove our fears, our blocks, and our resistances to it. Compassion is one of the most difficult and courageous of all our motivations, but it is also the most healing and elevating." Self-compassion is closely connected to self-acceptance, which we discussed in an earlier chapter, but it is even more than the acceptance of ourselves. It is actually having compassion for our human frailties and recognizing that we are vulnerable and limited like all people. As a result, it is a fundamental basis for developing compassion for others. It's hard to love others as you love yourself, as both men pointed out, if you don't love yourself. The Dalai Lama had mentioned during the week how he was shocked to hear from Western psychologists about how many of their patients wrestled with issues of self-hatred. Self-preservation, self-love, and self-care, he had assumed, are fundamental to our nature. This assumption is fundamental to Buddhist practice, so it was shocking to hear that people had to learn to express compassion not only to others, but also to themselves. Modern culture makes it hard for us to have compassion for ourselves. We spend so much of our lives climbing a pyramid of achievement where we are constantly being evaluated and judged, and often found to be not making the grade. We internalize these other voices of parents, teachers, and society at large. As a result, sometimes people are not very compassionate with themselves. People don't rest when they are tired, and neglect their basic needs for sleep, food, and exercise as they drive themselves harder and harder. As the Dalai Lama said, they treat themselves as if they are part of the machine. People tend to feel anxious and depressed because they expect themselves to have more, be more, achieve more. Even when people are successful and grab all the brass rings, they often feel like failures or frauds, just waiting to fall off the merry-go-round. Jinpa explains, lack of self-compassion manifests in a harsh and judgmental relationship with others. Many people believe that unless they are critical and demanding, they will be failures, unworthy of recognition and undeserving of love. Psychologist Kristen Neff has identified ways to express self-compassion. When we treat ourselves with compassion, we accept that there are parts of our personality that we may not be satisfied with, but we do not berate ourselves as we try to address them. When we go through a difficult time, we are caring and kind to ourselves as we would be to a friend or relative. When we feel inadequate in some way, we remind ourselves that all people have these feelings or limitations. When things are hard, we recognize that all people go through similar challenges. And finally, when we are feeling down, we try to understand this feeling with curiosity and acceptance rather than rejection or self-judgment. The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama had revealed throughout the week one of the core paradoxes of happiness. We are most joyful when we focus on others, not on ourselves. In short, bringing joy to others is the fastest way to experience joy oneself. As the Dalai Lama had said, Even 10 minutes of meditation on the well-being of others can help one to feel joyful for the whole day, even before coffee. When we close our heart, we cannot be joyful. When we have the courage to live with an open heart, we are able to feel our pain and the pain of others, but we are also able to experience more joy. The bigger and warmer our heart, the stronger our sense of aliveness and resilience. When Anthony Ray Hinton went to death row after a trial that can only be called a travesty of justice, he was understandably angry and heartbroken at how the American justice system had failed him. When no one believes a word you say, eventually you stop saying anything. I did not say good morning, I did not say good evening, I did not say a how do you do to anyone. If the guards needed some information from me, I wrote it down on a piece of paper. I was angry. But going into the fourth year, I heard a man in the cell next to mine crying. The love and compassion I had received from my mother spoke through me and asked him what was wrong. He said he had just found out that his mother had passed away. I told him, "Look at it this way. Now you have someone in heaven who's going to argue your case before God." And then I told him a joke, and he laughed. Suddenly, my voice and my sense of humor were back. For 26 long years after that night, I tried to focus on other people's problems, and every day I did, I would get to the end of the day and realize that I had not focused on my own. Hinton was able to bring love and compassion to a loveless place, and in doing so, he was able to hold on to his joy in one of the most joyless places on the planet. While he was in prison, he watched 54 people, 53 men and one woman, walk by his cell on their way to the execution chamber. He got his fellow inmates to start banging their bars at 5 minutes before the execution. I discovered on death row that the other inmates had not had the unconditional love that I had had from my mother. We became a family, and we did not know if they had any other family and friends there, so we were banging the bars to say to those who were being put to death, "We're with you. We still love you right up to the end." Pillar 8. Generosity. We are filled with joy.
I think that almost all of us are surprised how our joy is enhanced when we make someone else happy. You know, you go to town, you've gone to do some shopping, and when you get back home, you have a bunch of flowers for Rachel. She wasn't expecting them. And the glow of her face and the joy that comes from having made another person joyful is something that you can't actually compute. So our book says that it is in giving that we receive. So I would hope that people would recognize in themselves that it is when we are closed in on ourselves that we tend to be miserable. It is when we grow in a self-forgetfulness in a remarkable way, I mean we discover that we are filled with joy. I've sometimes joked and said, God doesn't know very much math. Because when you give to others, it should be that you are subtracting from yourself. But in this incredible kind of way, I've certainly found that to be the case so many times. You gave, and it then seems like, in fact, you are making space for more to be given to you. And there is a very physical example. The Dead Sea in the Middle East receives fresh water, but it has no outlet, so it doesn't pass the water out. It receives beautiful water from the rivers, and the water goes dank. I mean, it just goes bad. And that's why it is the Dead Sea. It receives and does not give. And we are made much that way too. I mean, we receive and we must give. In the end, generosity is the best way of becoming more, more and more joyful.
We had come to the eighth and final pillar of joy. Generosity is often a natural outgrowth of compassion, though the line between the two can be hard to distinguish. As Jinpa pointed out, we don't need to wait until the feelings of compassion arise before we choose to be generous. Generosity is often something that we learn to enjoy by doing. It is probably for this reason that charity is prescribed by almost every religious tradition. It is one of the five pillars of Islam, called zakah. In Judaism, it is called tzedakah, which literally means justice. In Hinduism and Buddhism, it is called dana, and in Christianity, it is charity. Generosity is so important in all of the world's religions because it no doubt expresses a fundamental aspect of our interdependence and our need for one another. Generosity was so important for our survival that the reward centers of our brain light up as strongly when we give as when we receive, sometimes even more so. As mentioned earlier, Richard Davidson and his colleagues have identified that generosity is one of the four fundamental brain circuits that map with long-term well-being. In the 2015 World Happiness Report, Davidson and Brianna Schuyler explained that one of the strongest predictors of well-being worldwide is the quality of our relationships. Generous, pro-social behavior seems to strengthen these relationships across cultures. Generosity is even associated with better health and longer life expectancy. Generosity seems to be so powerful that according to researchers David McClelland and Carol Kirschnett, just thinking about it significantly increases the protective antibody salivary immunoglobulin A, a protein used by the immune system. So it seems that money can buy happiness if we spend it on other people. Researcher Elizabeth Dunn and her colleagues found that people experience greater happiness when they spend money on others than when they spend it on themselves. Dunn also found that older adults with hypertension have decreased blood pressure when they are assigned to spend money on others rather than themselves. As the Archbishop had explained, we receive when we give. I had heard an amazing story that supported what the Archbishop was saying. When I met James Doty, he was the founder and director of the Center of Compassion and Altruism Research and Education at Stanford, and the chairman of the Dalai Lama Foundation. Jim also worked as a full-time neurosurgeon. Years earlier, he had made a fortune as a medical technology entrepreneur and had pledged stock worth $30 million to charity. At the time, his net worth was over $75 million. However, when the stock market crashed, he lost everything and discovered that he was bankrupt. All he had left was the stock that he had pledged to charity. His lawyers told him that he could get out of his charitable contributions and that everyone would understand that his circumstances had changed. One of the persistent myths in our society, Jim explained, is that money will make you happy. Growing up poor, I thought that money would give me everything I did not have. Control, power, love. When I finally had all the money I had ever dreamed of, I discovered that it had not made me happy. And when I lost it all of my false friends disappeared. Jim decided to go through with his contribution. At that moment, I realized that the only way that money can bring happiness is to give it away. Generosity is not just about the money we give. It is also about how we give our time. In the happiness literature, there's a great deal of research on the importance of having a sense of purpose. Purpose, fundamentally, is about how we are able to contribute and be generous to others, how we feel needed by and of value to others. A large meta-analysis by cardiologist Randy Cohen, conducted at the Mount Sinai St. Luke's Medical Center, found that a high sense of purpose correlates with a 23% reduction in death from all causes. In another study conducted by neuropsychologist Patricia Boyle and her colleagues and reported in JAMA Psychiatry, people with a sense of purpose were half as likely to develop Alzheimer's disease after 7 years. It's no surprise, then, that being generous with our time seems to be equally profound for our health. A large meta-analysis by Morris Okun and his colleagues have found, that volunteering reduces the risk of death by 24%. Compassion and generosity are not just lofty virtues. They are at the center of our humanity, what makes our lives joyful and meaningful.
Yes, there are many, many, many ugly things. But there are also some incredibly beautiful things in our world. The black townships in South Africa are squalor-ridden, and because of despair and disease, including HIV, children are orphaned. In one of the townships, I met a mother who had collected these abandoned children off the streets. She's got nothing much in the way of resources. But the minute she began doing that, help began coming for her to carry out her work of compassion. We are fundamentally good. The aberration is not the good person. The aberration is the bad person. We are made for goodness. And when we get opportunities, we mostly respond with generosity. She has got nothing. But that didn't stop her. And she had about 100 street children she picked up in a 3-room house. And before long, people got to know about it, who were able to say, "Okay, we will help. We will build a little dormitory for them." Others said, "We will give you food." And hey presto, she had a home. And she's becoming a legendary figure. But she wasn't driven by wanting fame or anything of the kind. It was just that she saw these children. And her maternal instinct said, "No, this won't do." And so, yes, I mean, one shouldn't pretend that people don't get overwhelmed by the sense of impotence. But do what you can, where you can.
At the Archbishop's 80th birthday, Rachel and I had gone with the Archbishop and his family to visit the orphanage and to celebrate with a giant cake. As some of the children sat on our laps on the floor in a room that was filled with dozens of other children, it was very hard not to want to adopt them all. The older children held the younger ones in their arms. They had all lashed their lives together in the shelter of the compassion and generosity of the mother who had taken them in. I remember the Archbishop saying that when he would visit townships, people who had nothing, absolutely nothing, would still open their homes and their hearts to others. Generosity is so deeply rooted in us.
And you are surprised when you go to a monastery or a convent where people live a very, very simple life, and you just have to accept that they have a peace that we who are always grabbing find elusive. Unless, of course, we sit loosely in relation to all of our wealth and all of our status, then we can be generous because we have really been made a steward of these possessions and these positions, and we don't hold on to them for dear life. So it's not the wealth and the status. These are neutral. It's our attitude. It's what we do with them that is so important. We said it on the very first day. When you become so inward-looking, so self-regarding, you are going to end up a shriveled human being.
There are ways to give even beyond our time and our money. Jinpa explained that in Buddhist teachings, there are three kinds of generosity. Material giving, giving freedom from fear, which can involve protection, counseling, or solace, and spiritual giving, which can involve giving your wisdom, moral and ethical teachings, and helping people to be more self-sufficient and happier. This was, of course, what the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop were giving all week long.
It's there, in front of our eyes. We have seen it. The people we admire are those who have been other-regarding, who even in the midst of a lot of hard work and so on, when you want to speak with them, they have a way of making you feel that at that precise moment, you are the most important thing they have to deal with. We don't have to bring in religion. I mean, it's a secular thing. Companies that are caring of their workers are more successful. Now, they could say, "Well, we pay them so much, and that's the end of our concern for them." Yes, well, okay, do that. And your workers will be workers who say, I work my shift from a certain time to a certain time and I finish. But when they have experience that you care about them as people, you know, you ask after them. You ask after their families, or at least have someone in your company whose business is looking after their welfare as people. It does increase productivity. I don't know what other evidence we want that would tell us that the caring corporation, the caring person, almost always, are the ones who do well. In fact, do very, very well. And the opposite is true as well.
Very true. Very true. It's quite obvious. Many Japanese companies are very successful because of the relationship between the employee and employer. The employees have the feeling that this is my company, so they work wholeheartedly. So with the employer that just cares about the profits, the employees will always be thinking about the lunch break or the tea time, never thinking about the company. If you build the real concept of working together and the profit is shared together, then real harmony develops. This is what we really need now. Harmony among the 7 billion human beings.
The Dalai Lama was weaving his hands together as if he could will the harmony of the world's population with his delicate fingers. I want to come back to what you were saying, Archbishop, about how you feel like our human nature's been distorted. What is it about our modern life that distorts our innate sense of compassion and generosity?
We have been brought up to think that we have to obey the laws of the jungle, eat or be eaten. We are ruthless in our competitiveness, so much so that now stomach ulcers are status symbols. They show just how very hard we work. We work hard not only to supply our needs and the needs of our families, but we are trying to outdo the other. We have downplayed the fact that actually our created nature is that we are made for complementarity. We have become dehumanized and debased. As Martin Luther King Jr. said, we must learn to live together as sisters and brothers, or we will perish together as fools. I hope that books such as this one will awaken in us that sense of being human. And then we will realize just how obscene it is for us to spend the billions or trillions that we spend on what we call a budget of defense, when a very small fraction of those budgets would ensure that, I mean, children die daily, die because they do not have clean water. That should not be the case if we were aware of our interconnectedness. And there's no way in which one nation is going to be able to prosper on its own. It can't. That's not how we were made. We were wired for this complementarity, this togetherness, this being family. And even if you think it is sentimental, it isn't sentimental. It's for real. When you produce a lot, and you don't say, by the way, there are people over there who are hungry, and instead you destroy the surplus, and you think it's going to be okay, it can't be okay. Because you have broken fundamental laws of the universe. And things will go horrendously wrong. You don't have to have scriptural or religious teaching. It's just the truth. You can't survive on your own. If you say you are going to be totally selfish, in next to no time the person who is totally selfish goes under. You need other people in order to be human. That's why when they want to punish you, they put you in solitary confinement. Because you can't flourish without other human beings. They give you things that you cannot give yourself, no matter how much money you have. And so we speak of Ubuntu. A person is a person through other persons. And there must have been some people who said, ah, what a primitive way of thinking. It's the most fundamental law of our being. We flout that? We flout it at our peril.
The Archbishop's eyes were transfixed. and he was speaking with the passion and power of an Old Testament prophet who was trying to save the people from ruin. I knew that speaking truth to power, as he always did, was exhausting. However, he did not seem depleted. Perhaps he was feeling energized by his role as a global village elder, who was still desperately needed to bring a moral voice. Nonetheless, I wanted to be careful to protect his limited strength. Archbishop, I want to be mindful of your energy. We have one last question related to this topic. How are you doing?
No, I'm fine.
For one more question?
You can give us as many as you like.
This question comes from Micah in South Africa. She asks, how can you be of service to people, nature, and causes in need without losing yourself completely to a crisis mentality? How can we help the world heal and still find joy in our own life?
My younger brother here, go first.
I think you know better.
This is the first time, please note, that he said, I know better.
Is the question about Africa?
No, this is about the world.
Okay. Now, I am always sharing with people that the problems we are facing today are very difficult to solve. An entire generation has been brought up with a certain mentality, with a certain way of life. So when we think about the future, how to build healthy humanity, we really have to think about how we create a new generation of citizens with a different kind of mindset. Here, education really is the key. Christianity has wonderful teachings. So does Buddhism. But these teachings and approaches are not sufficient. Now, secular education is universal. So now, we must include in formal education of our youth some teaching of compassion and basic ethics. Not on the basis of religious belief, but on the basis of scientific findings and our common sense and our universal experience. Just complaining about the present situation is not much help. It is very difficult to deal with our current world crisis because of our basic mentality. As you mentioned, your father was usually a very good man, but when he was drunk, he behaved badly. Today, I think many human beings are drunk. They have too many negative emotions like greed, fear, and anger dominating their minds, so they act like drunk people. The only way out of this drunken stupor is to educate children about the value of compassion and the value of applying our mind. We need a long-term approach rooted in a vision to address our collective global challenges. This would require a fundamental shift in human consciousness, something only education is best suited to achieve. Time never waits, so I think it is very important that we start now. Then maybe the new generation will be in a position to solve these global problems in their lifetime. We, the elder generation, have created a lot of problems in the 20th century. The generations of the 21st century will have to find the solutions for them.
I mean, people are fundamentally compassionate.
Yes, that is the basis of our hope.
I'm speaking.
The Dalai Lama laughed.
Even the most selfish person must have a modicum of compassion for his family. So we're not speaking about something alien. We are saying that we have discovered that we are interdependent.
Actually, Archbishop, I said, trying to bring our focus back to the topic, this question is for people who feel that interdependence profoundly and are so compassionate that it makes them world-sick and heart-sick. This person wants to know how she can find joy in her life while there are so many who are suffering.
Yes, very good. As an old man, I can say, start where you are and realize that you are not meant on your own to resolve all of these massive problems. Do what you can. It seems so obvious. And you will be surprised, actually, at how it can get to be catching. There are very many, many people. I mean, my heart leaps with joy at discovering the number of people who care. How many people walked in New York City for the environment? I mean, it was incredible. Nobody was going to pay them anything. But there they were, in droves. There are many, many people who care. And you will be surprised when you begin to say, well, I would like to do something relating to the aged. You will be surprised at the number of people who come forward and want to help. Why are there so many NGOs? I mean, it is people who say, we want to make a better world. We don't have to be so negative. Hey, remember, you are not alone. And you do not need to finish the work. It takes time. But we are learning. We are growing. We are becoming the people we want to be. It helps no one if you sacrifice your joy because others are suffering. We people who care must be attractive, must be filled with joy, so that others recognize that caring, that helping, and being generous are not a burden, they are a joy. Give the world your love, your service, your healing, but you can also give it your joy. This, too, is a great gift.
The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama were describing a special kind of generosity, the generosity of the Spirit. The quality they both have, perhaps more than any other, is this generosity of the Spirit. They are big-hearted, magnanimous, tolerant, broad-minded, patient, forgiving, and kind. Maybe this generosity of the Spirit is the truest expression of spiritual development, of what the Archbishop had said it takes time to become. The Archbishop had used a beautiful phrase to describe this way of being in the world, becoming an oasis of peace, a pool of serenity that ripples out to all of those around us. When we have a generous spirit, we are easy to be with and fun to be with. We radiate happiness, and our very company can bring joy to others. This, no doubt, goes hand in hand with the ability, as the Archbishop had pointed out repeatedly, to be less self-centered, less self-regarding, and more self-forgetful. Then we are less burdened by our self-agenda. We do not have anything to prove. We do not need to be seen in any particular way. We can have less pretension and more openness, more honesty. This naturally brings ease to those around us too, as we have accepted ourselves, our vulnerabilities, and our humanity. We can accept the humanity of others. We can have compassion for our faults and have compassion for those of others. We can be generous and give our joy to others. In many ways, it is like the Buddhist practice of Tonglen, which the Dalai Lama had used on the day he found out about the uprising and brutal crackdown